And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70 celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I am Ted Berg. I am joined in Zoom conference, as always, by the Athletics Mets beat writer, Tim Britton. Tim, the Mets have won a couple, won one, lost one since we spoke, some tight games in Arizona. But the big news to me, and something that only became clear in the late innings of Wednesday's game, is that the Mets now have a guy named Travis Blankenhorn on the team, and he wears number 73.
Yeah, Travis Blankenhorn, who they claimed off waivers from the Mariners because they got tired of the Mariners claiming all of their players on waivers. Infielder, left-handed hitter. This is his fourth organization this season. He's been with the Twins, the Dodgers, Seattle, and now the Mets. That's always a hard situation for a guy to be in, that kind of DFA purgatory. Mm-hmm. Like, you're good enough to get claimed, but not good enough to stick. And it's really hard to stay fresh, to get at bats, because you're just switching teams every fifth day or something like that. We'll see how he's able to handle it. And he might be playing a little bit larger role because of the day-to-day injury to Jonathan Villar, who had hamstring tightness on Wednesday. So it wouldn't be crazy if Blankenhorn got a start in San Diego this weekend.
My understanding of it is that Zach Scott, as we know, a virtuosic harmonica player, had taken a look at the Mets injury list and was just playing the blues, and you know, became frustrated with the limitations of that instrument, like changing keys and dynamics, and said, you know, just sort of screamed out, "Get me a Blankenhorn."
It's funny because I saw where you were going with that.
I apologize. I apologize. And this is never a place you really want to be, like in terms of jokes. But I think some credit goes to Chris Berman on that joke. So because he was Lance O'Darn, I sunk my Blankenship was a classic Chris Berman joke of yore. The Mets have maybe their toughest series of the season coming up.
Yeah, I mean, you'd probably have to say a four-game weekend series where you're missing a lot of pieces against a team that I believe is tied for the best record in baseball. No, they're behind San Francisco. Sorry, San Francisco has the best record in the National League and in baseball, I believe, going into play Thursday. But the Padres have played very well, played really well in the last week. I guess they've fallen off just a little bit. But you know, a team everyone expected to be very good, a team that is very good, a team that's going to be throwing its good starting pitchers against the Mets. They're getting Yu Darvish, they're getting Joe Musgrove, they're getting Blake Snell, who has not pitched as well this season, but is still a supremely talented pitcher and a left-hander to boot. So it's going to be an interesting test these next 2 weeks for the Mets. They've got four in San Diego this weekend. They get a little bit of a reprieve with a pair of days off around a two-game set in Baltimore next week against the worst team in the American League. And then it's a homestand where it's three against the Padres, four against the Cubs. Again, two teams that are well above 500, two teams that have played really good baseball over the last month or so. You know, the Mets are 2-10 against teams that are over 500 currently. They got swept by Chicago in Chicago, swept by Boston, swept by Tampa. They have not played their best against good teams. They haven't had many opportunities to at this point. So this will be an interesting challenge for them over the next couple weeks.
And you mentioned the pitchers they draw in San Diego. The thing about facing the Padres is any way you stack it up, really, you're going to get their good pitchers. They don't have a bad starting pitcher in their rotation with how well Musgrove and Darvish have been this year. And you know, you mentioned Snell has sort of been the weak link, but we know Snell is a guy who was pitching in the World Series not that long ago. Their bullpen has been excellent. They have a 2.85 staff ERA, the only team in the National League better than the Mets. But it does feel like, again, and we talked about this last show, but it continues to feel like the Mets' offense is coming around. We've seen more and more from Francisco Lindor, more from James McCann. Dominic Smith looks good again. Pete Alonso looks a lot better than he was before the injury. So am I wrong to feel kind of good?
No, I mean, like I wrote for this morning or late last night for Wednesday night that, you know, the way the Mets won Wednesday was the way they're going to have to win going forward. And it's getting big offensive contributions from the healthy regulars that they do have. We talked about it, a week or two ago, that if they were going to do well in June, they were going to need Dominic Smith. They're going to need Francisco Lindor. They're going to need James McCann to hit better than they had. And you've seen that from all three. Like I think I said, they need at least one of those guys to do something. And all three of them had nice series in Arizona. You know, throw Pete Alonso in there, having come back, and those four guys went 21 for 50. That's a .420 batting average, Ted. So that's the kind of offensive support they need. Those guys, they were 11 for 19 on Wednesday when they needed all seven runs that they scored. So you know, with the way the lineup is constructed, you know, you're only going to get so much out of Jose Peraza, and you know, Billy McKinney has had a nice start for them and gives them some pop at the bottom of the lineup, but is not a guy you want hitting third or fourth on a regular basis the way he had for a couple days. So if you've got that middle of the order, if you can go, you know, Lindor, Alonso, Smith, McCann, 2, 3, 4, 5 like that, and get some production out of it on a consistent basis, that's going to make it a lot easier to pitch your way to wins, and you're going to need the depth of your bullpen contributions the way they got yesterday with, you know, Robert Gazelman leading the way with 3 2/3, really good innings, getting multiple innings from both Seth Lugo, Miguel Castro, Edwin Diaz closing it down. You know, they're going to have they're going to have some bullpen games later in June because of the way the schedule is. They're going to have they're going to need those guys, the Gazelmans, the Drew Smiths, the Jacob Barnes, probably a Sean Reed Foley coming back from AAA, to give them good quality innings if they want to win games when they're playing two a day for a little while.
Yeah, I was happy to see Rojas go to Miguel Castro for multiple innings. I know he's been riding Castro pretty hard in the early part of the season, but so many times it's felt like Castro's been so good that he's gotten through an inning so efficiently that I'm left wondering, you know, why not bring him back for a second inning? And it seems like Rojas has avoided that to date. And if you look back at Castro's history, he is, you know, he has been by no means exclusively a one inning guy. When he first pitched with the Orioles, he was really mostly working in multi inning stints. Did plenty in his later years there as well. So I don't know. I felt like maybe it feels like Luis Rojas is loosening a little bit and starting to gain some confidence in himself as a manager.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are game contexts that make it more, you know, it's easier to throw Miguel Castro for two innings when you don't have Trevor May available, for instance, or if the game's tied. You know, you're not doing your usual like Castro 7th, May 8th, Diaz 9th formula. So they, you know, you have Miguel bridge that gap to Edwin Diaz himself the way he did on Wednesday. And you know, when your starter gets you one out the way David Peterson did, you kind of have to stretch the bullpen in ways that you probably would prefer not to on a regular basis. It is, like we talked about it the other day, it's interesting how they'll use Lugo and how Lugo's presence affects the way they use those other guys. You know, is Lugo a guy that's going to get set up opportunities where, you know, you give him the 7th and 8th on a consistent when he's available. And then the other day you give Castro the 7th and May the 8th. And that way everyone stays fresher. You know, that's always easier theoretically to do than practically. But his presence should make it easier. You won't need Castro and May on a daily basis the way you did at stretches earlier this season. And so when you do use them, you can think about using them for multiple innings. The thing you have tonight on Thursday night is that you've used Diaz back-to-back days. You've used Castro for two innings on Wednesday. You used Lugo for two innings on Wednesday. May has struggled a bit lately. like, what is the back part of that game look like if you get there with a one-run lead? That will be an interesting dynamic that Luis Rojas hopes that he has to deal with.
Yeah, you mentioned May struggling lately. I was going to say that it feels like Seth Lugo came back. I mean, obviously, we would have loved to see him back sooner, but came back at a good time because it does feel like it would be probably valuable to back off Trevor May for just a few days. Like, it feels like, you know, he was another guy who was rode real hard in the early part of the season.
Yeah, and he's struggled a bit with his slider. You know, that's a pitch that in 2019 when he was in Minnesota, he had a slider, he had a curveball. Neither one did much for him, and he was able to, like, basically combine the two. He was able to throw a pitch that was sharper and harder than the usual curveball, but had that kind of downward bite to it that a curveball has. So that was the pitch that kind of made him a really good late game reliever. And he hasn't had it the last couple of weeks. You saw on Tuesday, you know, it was the Josh Reddick. And so the walk to Pavin Smith, he couldn't throw that slider, couldn't get that slider in the right spot to finish off a hitter he got ahead 0-2 of. And then Josh, he did throw it in a decent spot, the first pitch to Josh Reddick, and Josh Reddick lined it down the line, fair or foul, however your perspective is on it, for the game-winning hit. So that's the pitch that's kind of eluded him to this point. May said he's been trying to build confidence in it. He'd relied more on his changeup earlier in the year than he's used to. And Luis Rojas has said, you know, if he's not getting that slider over, he doesn't have that kind of strike credibility with it, then guys can sit on his fastball. And as good as May's fastball is, he gets a lot of swings and misses up in the zone with it, that if guys are tuned into that's the pitch I'm looking for, they can catch up to 97 up in the zone and hit it a long way, and that's why he's given up some more home runs. You know, his home run rate is basically back to what his career norm is at the current moment. It was, you know, that was his issue in the last couple of years, and he gave up one home run the first several months of the season and has given up like three in the last couple of weeks, but that's going to happen to him. But if he gets that slider over, it should limit that to an extent.
And it stands out a little bit. You know, it's only three home runs, right? But it stands out because that's something that I think the Mets have done so well this year is limit. And I know, you know, some of it is probably just my eyes adjusting to the new ball a little bit. You know, it feels like the ball is flying out just less often in general. Certainly the Mets have not hit a ton of home runs. But the bullpen, especially Edwin Diaz, has not allowed a home run yet. Familia, no home runs yet. Castro's allowed two, but it feels like suppressing the long ball has been a big part of what's made this bullpen pretty valuable.
Yeah, I'd actually be interested in seeing how that compares across the sport. You know, like the Mets have not given up many home runs. They haven't hit many home runs. So it feels like home runs are down across baseball. And I think they are because we've been talking about the constitution of the baseball. But I don't really know actually like the extent of it. If home runs are down, you know, 3%, 8%, 20% for this time, you know, the usual first 2 months of the season. So that is something I should probably look up to contextualize what the Mets have done as an offense and what their pitching staff has done.
Yeah, I was going to say I probably should have looked that up before I asked it of you. But what happened to me was I got very caught up reading about gray uniforms on theathletic.com.
Yeah, so I ranked every team's road gray uniforms. Because I had spent several weeks writing stories and thinking, I haven't been yelled at enough on Twitter or in the comments to a story.
I want to cut you off. Are people yelling at you about this? Because it's so hard to get that mad about a gray uniform.
See, that's what I thought, that perhaps by taking something that almost no one has ever voiced a harsh opinion about, or like a really fervent, passionate opinion about in the past, that maybe I could write about uniforms without everyone hating everything that I wrote. But no, everyone hates everything that I wrote. Everyone hates that I ranked several American League Central teams towards the top.
You are a known good ranking. You're a known stan for the American League Central.
Who doesn't love traveling through Detroit and Cleveland?
Yeah. Rust Belt America, baby. Yeah.
For a June road trip.
I don't know, to me, so the Kansas City Royals, number one, I would say that felt like I was a little out of nowhere. I don't know that like anything especially notable I've noticed about the Royals Road Grays. They're fine that I look at them. But for the most part, I liked the list and I appreciated ranking the Mets number three, a great pull for the Mets, I think, and really a testament to the classiness. You know, I think that they're, to me, the Mets Road Grays look a lot nicer than whatever they've got going on at home.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're the Mets' nicest uniforms. I actually wrote this last year. We did the Athletic did like the New York writers talking about how they felt about the city's uniforms. I thought the Mets Road Grays were the nicest for a New York team because other people would write about the Yankees pinstripes and all that. They're so much better now that they've dropped the drop shadow on them that prevented them from wearing the blue hats with them. So it's just, you know, it's a nice, classy look. The pinstripes at home are also nice. I think they're good uniforms. The Mets, I think, overall have a pretty good set. The blue alternates I have no problem with. I like the road ones more than the home ones. They don't really wear the home ones much. I don't think they have yet this season. And they only wore them last year.
I really like the road alternate hat with like the gray. And I'm sort of a traditionalist about Mets hats, but I like the look with the silver center to the Mets logo.
Yeah, I think it's a nice subtle thing. Like teams used to, I think in the late 90s, teams did like the college thing where they started wearing gray hats on the road. Yeah, the Mets did it with the white hat at home. But like the Pirates and the Royals.
The Pirates, the Royals, and there was another team that did it. The Rockies did it for a little while.
Yeah, like that was too much, I think, going the full gray top. But to have like just a little gray logo with the orange outline, you know, it throws back to what the Mets did in the 80s. They had the blue alternates with the Mets in gray on the road. It's just a nice little subtle thing to be like, hey, we're on the road. This is how you know, which is why I made a big stink about like put your city name on your road jersey. That's a difference.
That was a point I was going to bring up that I'm very much aligned with you on, is that it seems so clear to me that you should be, when you're at home, you wear your nickname on the jersey, because that is how, because your home fans know who they're seeing and what city they're in when you are on the road. And I know it's 2021 and everyone knows where these teams are coming from at this point, but when you're on the road, you're representing your home, your team's home city. And to me, that should be on the front of the jersey.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only team that can maybe get away with it is Philadelphia, because that's a lot of letters. I feel that way in most sports. I guess in the NBA, you don't have teams that put their city name on the road jerseys as often. Well, they don't even have road jerseys anymore. So I don't even know how to approach the NBA's weird uniform convoluted schedule and all that. So I'll just excise that from the conversation.
We'll edit it out in post. Yeah.
the Phillies, the Rays, who ranked last, because we've talked about like the TB logo for Tim Britton and Ted Berg does not cut it. You like the TB logo, actually, right?
I'm good with the hat. I don't love the jersey. I think that it feels like a missed potential. The whole Rays set feels like they're so close and they just like haven't quite hit it yet.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I just feel like if they did this in green instead of navy, there are so many teams that are navy.
Yeah, and way too many teams.
Navy and gray. Look, it's a classic look. I wore it a lot in high school.
Territory Sean Hoyas. That's my colors.
But, you know, it's not the most, doesn't pop too much. So I think that's why, you know, several teams that had orange in them rated highly for me, because orange, you know, it looks good on gray. It pops a bit more. I wish the Rays, you know, the uniforms they had when they were green and they had Tampa Bay on the front and the little Ray darting across, those were better. I like those.
So better. I love the light blue color that is in their color scheme, and I feel like is underused. And I feel like that should be on the hat. Like they could go like UCLA sort of, maybe with some navy blue accents. I just think would be a much better look. And like you said, it's just, to me, it is about how many teams wear blue, either royal blue or navy blue. It's like every freaking team. And so that brings me to an important point. Because these are two points of contention I had with your ranking, is that you're pretty far down on the Colorado Rockies. And I love the Rockies uniforms. I like, I don't like the black, like sleeveless thing that they wear a lot, but I love their gray uniforms. I liked the road pinstripes when they had them. And I respect, first of all, that they are the purple team. And also that they're really the only of the 90s expansion teams, they're the only ones who've just stuck with their look. And I think it's held up well.
Yeah, I think they probably had the best look of those. I mean, certainly the Diamondbacks and Devil Rays did not have good looks when they came into the league. The Marlins have modulated their use of teal after a long stretch. They've gotten the color, the shade of purple right. As you can tell from the ranks, I really dislike pinstripes on the road. I don't think they work in general. Like the Rockies had them for a while. The Twins had them for a generation. The Diamondbacks had them briefly. The Padres have them now. And those jerseys, which I really disliked when they came out with them, look better to me now than they did then. But I still prefer when they just wear their brown because that's the color they should wear.
That was my second point of contention. I love those. I love the Padres, the pinstriped grays. I think those look great.
Yeah, like I'll see them next week when they come to Citi Field in person, which is, you know, is a different experience. But I think they're fine. But I would just prefer, you know, they were in the tier of like, I want you to wear your alternate jersey instead. And that is true for them. I think they're brown uniforms with the, I guess, are they calling them sand pants? The sand pants. Look is their best look out of the three new ones that they have.
Well, and that makes for a fine transition to the last point or discussion I wanted to make on the topic of road uniforms. And you sort of alluded to it, and it's outside the scope of this column, certainly, because you set out to rank gray uniforms and you rank the gray uniforms. But there has been a recent trend returning to something that we saw in the late, or we didn't see because we weren't watching baseball then. I saw some of it in the 80s, but the return of powder blue uniforms, we've seen a little bit. Now, what bugs me about that is that it used to be powder blue road uniforms, and some of the teams, I think the Phillies especially, have now taken on the powder blues for home, and that bothers me a little bit. But where are you on the powder blue as a road scheme instead, like replacing the gray?
I think it's okay for teams to, I don't want to see the entire league in powder blue. I think it's something mm-hmm. that if it works with your color scheme, you can go with it. You know, like the Mets never went to powder blue.
No,
the Mets
would
look ridiculous in powder blue. There are certain teams that, you know, like the Royals, it worked with their color scheme. The Expos, who I believe were the first team to go with powder blue when they came in 1969. I don't know if anyone, maybe the Seattle Pilots also used it in 69 for their single season. So then the Brewers became the team that had it because they just basically took right. the Pilots uniform inventory and kept it and rearranged some letters. Like the reason the E's were lowercase was because that was how the Pilots had it. Seattle, not Pilots. There's no E in Pilots. So I think there are teams where it could work. Like the Cardinals powder blues, I think, look really nice. And
yeah.
They show that you can have St. Louis on a jersey and it looks good. The S and L could both hang off the bat if they wanted. So I'm okay with certain teams doing it. I think like it would be fine with me if certain teams wore their alternate jersey most of the time on the road. The Pirates, black jerseys. They've worn black in the past as their road uniform in the 70s when they were really good. I think their black uniforms are quite sharp now with the script. That would be fine with me. The Brewers navy jerseys are really nice. I think it's weird that what the Phillies are doing, because it's like you do a throwback uniform, you want your home fans to see it, but you throw back to your road uniform.
It's very odd. And I love, and you're not, you said you're not someone who pines for that uniform. I love that old Phillies uniform. Because again, it's a different color, right? It's maroon. There's no maroon team.
The first time that my first Little League team where we had the actual uniform instead of just a t-shirt that said the league name, we had like a uniform that said our team name. I was on the Phillies in like second grade. But it was a dark maroon jersey because the league did not like refresh its uniform stock year after year. And it had the bright red current Phillies hat. So we were the worst dressed team in the league because we had it. I've always thought the red is a little too bright and the dark red is a little too dark.
Yeah, I hate that. The Phillies current uniforms, I hate. It looks like something from like a, I've heard this comment made about the Marlins, but like it looks like something from like a video game that is like very poorly rendered. It's just so, I don't know, it's like weirdly old timey, but not in a classy way. It just, I hate it. And it's not just because it's the Phillies, because like I don't have strong feelings about the Nationals or Braves uniforms other than obviously the imagery that the Braves are going to get rid of at some point.
Yeah, I think the Phillies, the pinstripes seem a little bright, and then the name and number font is a little too close to Comic Sans.
It's like Comic Sans, yeah. It's horrible. Horrible. It's just like, what are you doing? And especially when you have that maroon in your past, it just seems like such a natural thing to go back to. Would you be, what if, so we talk about powder blue, what if teams incorporated, and this is something, and I know, I feel like you're going to be conservative about this, but for me, I'm all about pushing the envelope. I think that, like, I think I have such a strong distaste for the idea of being in uniform for any reason that, like, I want the uniforms to be as different as possible. Well, where would you stand if, like, the Rockies came out with, like, a powder purple, like a lavender road color? Why are you laughing? I think that would be dope.
I would be intrigued. I did suggest that they should just put Dinger on their uniforms because yeah. Why not? Dinger is my favorite non-Mr. Met mascot. He's my favorite non-baseball head mascot. I'm intrigued in pushing the envelope. I'd have to see what it looks like. I can't conceptualize what lavender looks like in a full outfit, all lavender, lavender shirt, lavender pants.
Amazing. It would look amazing.
That would look so cool. I'm intrigued by your ideas, and I would like to sign up for your newsletter.
Fantastic. I really got to start a newsletter. Last, and to the same point, I would, and I'm guessing you were down on them, but I liked the, when the Diamondbacks had the, like the charcoal gray road uniforms. Where were you on that?
The charcoal was bad. They were, I called them maybe the worst road uniforms in the history of the sport. But that was like, it wasn't just that they went charcoal. It was, they had the weird diamond pattern that made them look darker, and that they, like the lettering and the numbers were not bright enough to offset the chart. Like the whole thing was dark. So nothing stood out. Like, you can have a charcoal road uniform. You just need to understand that the rest of the uniform is charcoal when you're designing the other elements to make them stand out differently. So I did not like them. I thought the Diamondbacks' current uniforms, which are not great, but the ones that do incorporate teal, I really like. They didn't wear them at all this week, but like the home uniforms, the home whites that have the teal number, I think that's the best look the Diamondbacks have ever had, and they just don't wear it enough.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, and I will accept that explanation for the charcoal thing. I thought that just the charcoal itself was cool. I didn't especially love that set of uniforms, which also, if you'll recall, and I don't know if they went with it forever, but at the very beginning, they had, like, on the pants, it looked like there were splashes up the back of the legs, and one of them was red. And so the first time you saw the Diamondbacks come out and like the pants with like red splatter on there, he's like, have the Diamondbacks been like stomping around in blood? What is going on here? That was a weird choice. But I don't know. I just support anyone trying anything, like Nathan Hirsch, who asked us on Twitter, went far out with a listener question this week. I feel like I'm killing the segues. Nathan wants to know, if you could clone Jacob deGrom 8 times, I'm going to question 8, but clone him 8 times and have him play all 9 positions and bat 1 through 9, would that team make the playoffs? Would it win the World Series? He says, okay. He allows, the offense would be weak, but probably enough to score a run or two.
So there's a difference between cloning him 8 times and cloning him 25 times.
Right. Huge difference. Because yeah. I think 25 times, I think maybe, yes, it makes the playoffs. And 8 times, I don't. Because I don't think you have enough. Because if you need a bowl, and assuming not all 9 DeGroms can pitch every day, and you can't just rotate which 9 guys you have, then I don't see it. I feel like they're too thin on Jacob DeGroms.
Right, you can't take the Jacob DeGrom who throws the first 7 innings of the game and put him at first base for the rest of the game, and then take the Jacob DeGrom who started at second base on Monday and start him on Tuesday. I think if we're operating under we're all setting our own rules here. If we're operating under the principle that you need a 26-man roster to get through this, then 9 Jacob DeGroms and 17 other dudes. The 17 other dudes would not, if they're replacement level, bullpen and bench.
Well, I just think you would much rather have, if you had 9 Jacob DeGroms, you would just make that your pitching staff, right? And you would and then get other guys to play the field and bat.
Yeah, so let's take it as a more interesting question of 26 Jacob DeGroms. So you've got, every inning is going to be pitched by Jacob DeGrom, but every at-bat is going to be taken by Jacob DeGrom. And I think, the defense would not be terrible. I think it would be below average.
I don't think he would be like a major league average shortstop, just because major league shortstops are exceptionally good. But you don't think Jacob DeGrom would be like a plus third baseman or second baseman?
I don't know that he'd be plus. I think he could probably, I think he'd be slightly below average at shortstop. It depends on how much time.
We've got time. We've got a full spring training. Nathan didn't set this out. I've decided we have a full spring training to iron out all of our Jacob DeGroms.
Yeah, and so the position that he played well in college, the position that could have gotten him drafted, that he was not that far off from being a potentially good major league defender at, was shortstop. And if you're good at shortstop, you can be good at other positions. Catcher would probably be the hardest one for him.
But he'd have a gun, right? Like, who's going to run on Jacob DeGrom? It's like coming a 102 with tail to the second baseman. They're going to break hands.
So maybe by the end of the season, the defense would be fine. But I think it would be a process. There'd be some misreads in the outfield, probably.
No way.
So your pitching staff, if we're operating under 2021 numbers, you would give up less than a run per 9 innings. So you do fine, and your lineup would be hitting 450. If you take a larger sample and say, okay, he's going to pitch to around a 2 ERA, because his ERA since 2018 is just below 2, so you'd give up 2 runs a game. Your OPS plus in that time is, I believe, 44 for DeGrom. So you'd have to find ways to score 3 runs a game with an offense that had a 44 OPS plus. I think that's a team that probably goes like 85 and 77. Is my guess, but there's probably enough games where he shuts you out or gives up just the 1 run that you can sneak by scoring 2 with some consistency. The thing with DeGrom is that he's not like, there are those really good pitchers who have 3 ERAs at the end of the year and they'll throw like 3 shutouts, but also have, their handful of starts where they get blown up a bit. Mm-hmm. Like James Shields, I feel like was that way during his prime.
Big game James.
But DeGrom doesn't have those like games where he goes 6 and gives up 4 that often. Like he had, 3 in the start of 2019, and that's all I can remember.
And when it happens, you're like, what's happening? Oh, no. Something's wrong.
So he's more consistently giving up just the 0, 1, or 2 that keeps you in games and makes this like it's plausible that they could win games that way. I'm trying to like the only other player like Shohei Ohtani would obviously be the one guy you'd want 26 of.
Right. Yeah. I was gonna say this was a much more fun thing to discuss before Shohei Ohtani existed on the major league landscape because he is just so obviously the choice for the clone army scenario.
But beyond that, I'm not sure if there's any position player who you'd even Mike Trout or Mookie Betts or guys who are awesome position players and really good in a lot of different ways. I don't know that you could survive with them pitching consistently. Who would have been great at this? Desi Relaford. Desi Relaford would have been a great player to have throughout because he could pitch.
See, I would be interested. I'm sure that someone smarter than me and with access to more stats can figure this out. I would think that, you know, because there's a lower limit to run scoring, like Jacob DeGrom's never going to allow negative runs in a game, right? Like that would be impossible. So, and because even the most dominant pitchers in baseball still allow two runs a game, as DeGrom has in the past 3 years, and that's otherworldly dominance. Whereas there is no upper limit to run scoring. I don't know. Like, I wonder if a team full of Mike Trouts, healthy Mike Trouts with like 450 on base percentages, if they're just going to, because a certain number of hard hit balls are just going to be outs no matter what. So like, would Major League, I guess, except yes, I think that Major League hitters would probably hit like Mike Trout off Mike Trout. And so that's your answer, right? So, you know, so then it would just be a bunch of like 14, 13 games, but probably, yeah, you're probably right. Like you, DeGrom, certainly for being such a good defender as a pitcher, such a good athlete, and relatively such a good hitter by pitching standards. Also, I feel like just like cagey, like he's just got that guile that he's going to figure out ways to beat you. Yeah, he's outside of Ohtani, he's a really good choice.
Yeah, this might be a something I try to dive into more in depth in like the off season when I'm not covering games regularly, is how good would a team of 26 Jacob DeGroms be based off his numbers over different periods of time? Because yeah, like it's, you can imagine him like laying down squeeze bunts to score because to score a different DeGrom from third because of his athleticism. It's, you know, it's too bad that cloning technology is just not far enough along at the current moment to think about this more seriously. Is it too bad? That's probably a good thing.
Because I think you'd have to clone like a fetal Jacob DeGrom, and then so you'd have to wait 25 years or so to, and like for DeGrom, you'd have to wait 31 years to get him at this good. And you'd have to recreate the entire, you know, you'd have to like, you know, he's Jacob DeGrom, but you can't let him pitch in college because this Jacob DeGrom didn't pitch in college or didn't until, you know, was a closer and a shortstop. So it's a very difficult thing to navigate, for sure. But I would, if we work out cloning, this is the type of thing I would like to see, because I would love to imagine what it would be like to be a major league hitter and see the manager coming out to the mound to pull Jacob DeGrom. The manager is also Jacob DeGrom. And you look out to the bullpen, and who's out there? It's two Jacob DeGroms.
Would
right fielder Jacob DeGrom at the bullpen, where like the bullpen coach and the bullpen catcher are all Jacob DeGrom.
Would any of them throw left-handed with, like, I don't know science well enough. Would, like, there be, like, a weird cloning mutation where, like, oh, this one came out and threw lefty? Or
if you're starting from youth.
Condition one to throw lefty.
Yeah, I think if you're starting from youth, because, like, Billy Wagner famously was not left-handed, right?
Right.
He was just, like, and it's a weird thing if you were right-handed, and if you ever tried throwing left-handed, it feels so horribly unnatural. But it is the same muscles that you're using, and so, like, I know, I think that it's Yu Darvish, I think, and we all know, you know, Ichiro Suzuki did a lot of batting practice right-handed, and I believe Yu Darvish can throw in the 80s with his alternate hand, and because I think that is, like, more, I don't know that this is something, like, I remember reading about a lot, like, someone hypothetically talking about a wrong-handed Darvish facing a wrong-handed Suzuki. And so I assume that is because it is more part of the training in Japan, but I don't know that for sure and don't want to like make assumptions. But I know that it is like, that is something that there are some people who like, if you have the capacity to throw 100 righty, if you start from a young enough age, I think that because it's just about like your quick twitch explosiveness and such, you would be able to throw really hard lefty just from training it.
Yeah, like I'm watching Pat Venditti strike out the side, like one guy righty, two guys lefty, in one inning in a minor league game several years ago. This is like the first time I saw Pat Venditti. And after the game, one of the players who struck out in the clubhouse, this was in Pawtucket, just goes like, they should give that guy the Cy Young. That was the most incredible thing ever. I don't care that it's the minor leagues. I don't care that I'm the guy he struck out. Like that, you should get the Cy Young for that inning alone at whatever level you pitch.
Yeah, I mean, that's like kind of like the thing with Ohtani, right? It's like, this guy's got to be the MVP because he can do both things.
Yeah, and it's he would be the most interesting player on, well, he's still more interesting than Trout, but Trout is so close to him and how good and how fun he is to watch for a fourth place Angels team. Are they even in fourth? They might be in fifth.
They're in fourth. Thankfully, they have the Texas Rangers coming up behind them. But yeah, it is, as a big Mike Trout fan, and Trout's hurt now, which has become like sort of the other frustrating thing with Trout, is that he is, he has been, you know, missing more and more time over the past few years. But yeah, man, is it frustrating that the Angels can't ever seem to be good? And it's extra frustrating because it's not even like for a lack of financial commitments, really. Like, it's just they've just been doing the wrong thing for so very long. But that is far from the topic of this podcast, which is the New York Mets, who as you've mentioned, have a tough part of the schedule coming up. And you and I assume, will be back with some discussions of this schedule.
Yeah, we'll be back after the San Diego series, so we'll see how the Mets survive this first real challenge at Petco Park. This was always like a series that, regardless of how the Padres were, the Mets would lose 3 out of 4, all by a score of 2-1. When I remember watching them in college and stuff in 06 and 07, it seemed like they always had a tough trip through San Diego, and I wanted the Mets to avoid playing the Padres in like the 06 playoffs. I feared San Diego in that NLCS much more than I feared St. Louis, which, my bad.
Now we know where to, you know, for all this time we've been blaming Carlos Beltran. Tim, we, as mentioned, we will be back. If you have a question for the show, as Nathan did, he asked us on Twitter. I'm at OG Ted Berg. Tim is at Tim Britton. If you don't have Twitter or you have a longer question than 280 characters, you can email me at asktedberg@gmail.com. Please rate, review, subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts and wherever else you listen. Thank you, as always, for listening. And Tim, peace out.
Adios.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.